with Truth News Radio Australia, and it's the 18th of September 2013. Welcome, folks, to another show. My name's Harold Fenton, and for the next 2 hours, we are going to be going on a whirlwind trip through some very, very stormy conditions indeed. In the second hour, I have a guest joining us from Damascus in Syria. Franklin Lamb is an independent writer who has been in the Middle East for many years, writing articles submitted to various publications, and he looks for facts and generally provides a refreshing counterpoint to the sort of monotonous conformity of mainstream news reporting that we see coming from that part of the world. And with, you know, all eyes on Syria at the moment in this really, really tense moment in history, really, it's going to be quite interesting to talk to a man who is on the ground and can give us a feeling for what is really happening there and what people really think. There's a few things about the Syrian situation which I want to highlight again, because they tend to be lost again and again in the way in which this story is approached by virtually the entirety of the world's media. The first point that I want to re-emphasize is that the Syrian crisis, the current phase of it, right, really depends on questions of veracity of facts and the credibility of various players. The issue of who was responsible for the chemical weapons attacks is one of these fundamental truth issues that we raise so often on this show, and which I found so often are at the heart of catastrophes in history. We find that there are actually two versions of a story, two versions of an event that would lead to completely different outcomes and completely different paths into the future, depending on which view was adopted. And what we've seen is that where there are forces that wish to create war, that wish to create a discord, which I believe are essentially controlled by those who profit financially from these catastrophes, where we see that there are these critical bifurcation points in history, this is where we see most commonly what is well known now among the research community as the false flag. The false flag being a method by which to create a perception that will then allow the outcomes that had already been planned and intended. And what I find incredible is that after so many examples of this, over so many decades, over so many generations, that there is this kind of dim-witted naivety among the media and also among world leaders, politicians, statesmen, diplomats, that they cannot simply see through what is obviously a false flag. Or to put it in more conventional terms, a frame-up. Now, the latest rhetoric that we're getting from the powers that be are that, well, now that the UN report has been released, they're basically saying it's proven now that the Assad regime was responsible for this chemical weapons attack. But note, the UN report itself does not seek to prove that. There is no official proof of that anywhere. But we have statements such as that from the French foreign minister, Mr. Fabius, who said that this report conclusively pointed to the Assad regime as being responsible for the attack. And here's a direct quote. This is what the French foreign minister said. When you look at the amount of sarin gas used, the vectors, the techniques behind such an attack, as well as other aspects, it seems to leave no doubt that the Assad regime is behind it. Now, aside from the very obvious wordplay there, seems to, other aspects which are not defined, which of course is all weasel words, the implication here is what they're saying is that, well, we found that they've used this sarin gas. They've actually used it with armaments that appear to be not homemade. This is some of the other observations we're getting, which were actually derived from the report, that that the weapons were not homemade, that it was sarin gas. And then they jumped to the conclusion that, oh, it couldn't possibly be the rebels. No, no, no. The rebels would never be able to get access to this sort of thing. Oh, no. I mean, how pathetic and naive or deliberately obtuse is that? I mean, of course, the rebels didn't make the sarin gas themselves. The rebels didn't make the armaments themselves. They didn't make the shells. We know that. They got them from somewhere else. And there are many places they could have got them from, including Saudi Arabia, for which we already have credible evidence. But no. And the constant echo from the mainstream media on this is, we can't imagine how the rebels could have got these things. Well, it must be the government then. And, you know, that is just pathetic, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, we're talking here about grown men and women with extensive experience of life, professional people, and they can't even apparently put two and two together to see that this is not an obvious frame-up. And this is where I have to really take my hat off to Vladimir Putin, who is the only world leader who has simply been willing to say what is obvious, to say the emperor has no clothes, to basically point out what anyone, what blind Freddy could see, is that this looks very much like a frame-up. And why, you might say, why would they frame up the Assad government? Well, look at the situation. The only way of getting Western intervention into Syria would be by some dramatic act that would put the Syrian situation in the context of an R2P type situation, responsibility to protect, for which the pretext is already there, for which the wording already exists in UN resolutions. So there's every motive in the world for the rebels to go along with that. And there's also every motive in the world for foreign powers to provide the rebels secretly with these weapons. And you know, those foreign powers could be Saudi Arabia, because we know Saudi Arabia are heavily behind supporting the extremist Islamists in Syria. And we know, of course, Saudi Arabia is a completely corrupt, completely tyrannical, completely morally bankrupt regime. But of course, it could be Israel, because we know Israel has a huge amount to gain from Western intervention and basically lockdown of Syria. And we know that Israel has chemical weapons. We know Israel has sarin gas. These are not contested. What I'm saying to you is not in the realm of speculation. These are facts. And we know that Israel has a long history of interfering in other countries, launching premeditated attacks on other countries that aren't even in self-defense. They're just simply attacks, such as we saw a couple of years ago when they bombed Syria, and going back decades when they bombed other countries and, of course, launched wars back in the 60s and, of course, bombed a US surveillance ship, the Liberty. The Israel government should be on the list of suspects. But, of course, there's more. There are more on this list. Of course, the US government certainly should be on the list of suspects as to who supplied the sarin gas to Assad. Sorry, I'm thinking so fast, I'm getting confused and my words are getting all mixed up. I mean, this is such an outrageous situation. And I really feel compelled to just share with you my exasperation and to try and be a voice of common sense and basic intelligence when all around what we are seeing is utter, you know, Looney Tunes, you know, fruitcake kind of level alphabet soup from the way in which these stories are being reported. Let's take a look now at some recent news stories. I have an article here from the New York Times. Security Council returns to role in Syria conflict. And this covers some of the same ground I was just describing there earlier with the comments by the French foreign minister. Thrust back into a central role in resolving the Syrian conflict, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council met on Tuesday to negotiate a draft resolution that would hold Syria to its pledge of identifying all chemical weapons under government control for destruction. But diplomats said major differences over a draft quickly emerged. The diplomats, who declined to be identified, said Russia, Syria's most important ally, was resisting components of the draft, composed by the three Western permanent members, Britain, France, and the United States, that discuss the threat of force to ensure Syrian compliance, whether to condemn the Syrian government for chemical weapons use, and whether suspected users should be referred to the International Criminal Court for a war crimes prosecutions. The discussions are unlikely to produce a quick resolution, the diplomat said, and it is unclear when a draft will be ready to vote. Now, remember back a few days ago when this agreement was first announced in a very, very cocky manner by John Kerry, sort of taking the credit for it and asserting with absolute assurance that this agreement would be under Chapter 7. Chapter 7 is a particular context within UN agreements which would allow for the use of force. And when Kerry announced the agreement, he simply said, well, this will be an agreement that will be backed up under Chapter 7, meaning that if the Syrians do not follow through, the Western powers would move immediately towards a military intervention. The Russians immediately came back and said that that wasn't true. There's been a back and forth on this for the last week, with Lavrov saying, no, it's not, the Americans saying, yes, it is. You know, no, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. Yes, it is. And now finally, here they are sitting down to write the draft resolution. And guess what?
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
With Truth News Radio. It's great to have your company today, and do check us out if you get a chance. Pop over to truthnews.com.au, check out our podcasts and our articles, and you can subscribe there. I will be releasing an upgraded version of the website soon, which is going to be optimized for mobile platforms. It'll work really well on your smartphone. It'll work really well on your tablet. And it will have a better layout and better features. I've put quite a lot of work into that because I really want the website to be able to reach as many people as possible. We will also be launching a subscription service for the site, and that's coming up. But don't worry, if you're someone who doesn't have the capacity to support us financially, you won't be required to pay. The core content will still be available, although the ad-free content may require a subscription account to access. But I do stand by my belief in the fact that it's most important that the content, the core content, remains available to anyone who needs it. Because the main point here, the main point of what we're trying to achieve with this show, what I personally want to do, is I want to be on the right side of history. That's why I do this show. I want to feel like I was part of the solution, not part of the problem. And, you know, when most of us who are struggling in our lives think about what we can do, we feel so limited and we end up just... And this is no judgment, by the way, no judgment here. But what happens is we end up falling back into a kind of a cynical way of justifying doing nothing. We basically say, look, I've got to get by. I can't really change the world. It's all too hard. I need to make a living. I can't do some very complex thing or some very difficult thing that might cause me to lose my job. So I'll just keep my head down, do nothing. You know, that unfortunately is the way most people think. And again, it's no judgment because I'm that way too. I've been that way for many years. And in fact, for many years, this show has really been extremely limited in terms of what its achievements are, simply because I wasn't willing to sacrifice certain other things in my life. And I kept this show into a very tightly corralled part of my life, which meant that it was very limited. But I've now decided that I can't do that anymore. I can't justify doing that anymore to myself. It doesn't feel right anymore. And I'd rather take the risks associated with going all out into making a difference, making a stand, making a difference, and take this show to another level. So that's what I'm trying to do. And if listeners out there can help me, fantastic. At least then, you know, and I say this with all sincerity, you know, you can actually feel that you're contributing to something that's Australian and homegrown too. Because it's hard to know even how to contribute, isn't it? It's hard to know where to spend your money, what to do. I mean, I've run events in Sydney where we put on film nights. We've had hundreds of people turn up. And people have said, look, they want to do something, they want to be part of something, but they don't know what to do. And I certainly wasn't in a position to tell them what to do. So they just all left again. This happened over and over again. We've got these big crowds turning up. No one knows what to do. This is a big problem with movements, a problem with leadership. A lot of time people expect there to be a leader there to tell them what to do. But then a lot of times people say, oh, we shouldn't have any leaders. But both of those positions, folks, are wrong. They're misguided positions. The position that says we don't need a leader is wrong. You do need leaders, okay? You need leaders. And the people who are saying we don't need a leader, they're the ones who need a leader most of all, because they're the people who aren't moving in any direction. Now, the people who are saying, where's the leader? Show me the leader. I need to be led. These people, hard in the right place, but they don't understand is that they need to be leaders. There's plenty of room for leaders, folks. It's not as if there's only like room for one at the top. There is an infinite space for leaders in the world. The reality is there's a lack of leadership in the world. There are puppets, figureheads in charge all over the place who are either incompetent or completely corrupt and in league with evil. And these are the ones who assume the mantle of leadership, who are called leaders but aren't leaders at all. So for those of you who are frustrated that there isn't a leader, again, I say to you, be a leader. And I know it's hard. I know as soon as you think about that, you suddenly think, well, hang on, I've got my whole life. I've got my job, I've got my mortgage, I've got my kids, I've got my wife, I've got my family, I've got my mother, how can I do this without jeopardizing all of that? Yeah, exactly. It ain't easy. But that's what anyone who wants to be a leader has to deal with. And it's not easy for anyone. It's not easier for some person A or person B or person C. Being a leader is always hard, and the hardest thing is actually realizing that you're going to have to make some sacrifices, realizing that you're going to have to take some risks, realizing that you're possibly going to invest a vast amount of effort into something which is not going to return anything much at all for a very long time. And that is the main reason why most people do not want to be leaders and look to a leader who they think is someone who knows how to do it and is trained and is ready to do it and kind of enjoys it. We don't enjoy it either. People who are leaders don't enjoy being leaders. They'd rather be doing something else. Anyway, rant aside, let me continue now with the news I was covering earlier. I want to turn now to a story from Great Britain. This is just the latest sort of blast of rhetoric from the British leader, Prime Minister David Cameron. Prime Minister David Cameron warned against standing by as atrocities were perpetrated in Syria during a speech in which he discussed the lessons of the Holocaust. Somehow, when genocide is taking place, the shame of not acting sometimes doesn't quite register properly until afterwards, the Prime Minister said, just hours after the United Nations confirmed that chemical weapons had been used in Syria, but stopped short of saying who was behind it. This is from NBC, by the way. When something truly terrible happens, it's as if we put up a defence mechanism and try and rationalise why we are powerless to act. And Cameron referred to the 1995 Srebrenica massacre in the former Yugoslavia and the 1994 slaughter of Tutsis in Rwanda. The same could so easily be true of Syria, Cameron said, at an event marking the 20th anniversary of Britain's Holocaust Educational Trust. With me as Prime Minister, Britain will never stand by. Cameron also linked the use of chemical weapons in Syria to Israel. And let's not forget, he said, chemical weapons also pose a massive potential threat to Israel. And Israel has warned that it is prepared to take military action if it thinks Syrian weapons are falling into the hands of arch-enemy Hezbollah. Now, I read that to you to highlight again the brazen, outrageous level of propaganda that is taking place, and how more, you know, what more appropriate way to do it than to conflate the Syrian situation with the Holocaust. You know, I mean, the Holocaust is a great resource for those who wish to justify any kind of extreme action, because the Holocaust, of course, the most horrendous evil that we can think of that took place in the last century, and merely mentioning Syria in the context of the Holocaust is enough to stir people up. And I thought it was interesting that he used Israel there in his argument, but rather than mentioning that Israel actually has chemical weapons, which is the main worry, he says that Israel may actually be a victim of chemical weapons. Isn't it ludicrous? Stay right there. We'll be right back after the break. We'll be covering more of the Syrian story. Don't go away. Thank you. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And still on the Syrian situation, I turn now to a recent article published in Australia's national online news service, www.abc.net.au. And this, again, returns to the clash between Russia and France. Russia and France clash publicly over responsibility for Damascus chemical weapons attack. France, along with the United States and Britain, wants the resolution, this is the UN resolution, to threaten serious consequences if Syria does not adhere to a deal to eradicate its chemical weapons, while both Russia and China are opposed to such a move. The meeting comes after the French and Russian foreign ministers clashed publicly over who is to blame for last month's chemical weapons attack in Syria. The clash, which highlighted the fundamental differences within the Security Council, followed the publication of the UN report confirming the nerve agent sarin was used on civilians in Damascus. France's Laurent Fabius, backed by a number of other nations, said the report left little doubt that the Assad regime was responsible. And I read to you earlier a couple of the quotes from Fabius. But of course, this is completely countered. This is diametrically opposed by the Russians. And Sergei Lavrov has said this: "We have serious grounds to believe that this was a provocation, and several of our partners, without irrefutable proof, announced that only the Assad regime could use such chemical weapons." Let me play to you now a little clip here from the ABC's coverage of this topic, and I may pause it here to give you my own commentary.
Well, it's interesting, the fact that we saw that agreement between the US and Russia that they would try and get rid of the Syrian chemical weapons, and that clearly didn't mean that there was going to be much agreement anywhere else. So we've had the five permanent members in New York at the UN. They're working on this draft resolution that the Western-based powers are putting forward. The Russian representative came out of that meeting and said he wasn't going to comment about the draft resolution. On the other side of the world, we've had the French and Russian foreign ministers sitting at the same table arguing over who was actually to blame for it, because this report that came out yesterday, the US said, look, it proves our case, it proves what we've been saying. Our intelligence was just as good, and it shows that the Assad regime was to blame. The Russians are still suggesting that it could be homemade weapons and that the rebels could have launched this attack on those people and killed those numbers. So
just pause it there. Now, notice again the language here. The Americans said the report proves, but remember, the report didn't prove anything about that. The report, the specific mandate of the report was not to prove that. And notice again, no backup, no follow through of what the specific proof was, simply referring to it as if it already exists. Ladies and gentlemen, we have seen this again and again and again in the coverage of this whole topic. It is pathetic. It's an outrage, and every major news agency is doing the same thing. This lady, Lisa Miller from the ABC, is doing the same thing, playing along with it. And she referred to there the concept of homemade. And I think she's misrepresented there, the Russian position. No one is suggesting that the militants used homemade sarin gas. I don't think you can make sarin gas at home, okay? That's never been proposed. That's not what most likely happened. What most likely happened, and it's so obvious and so easy to understand, so easy to grasp, that I can only think that you deliberately refuse to acknowledge it, is that someone supplied the rebels with a few cylinders of sarin gas and the means to deliver it on the back of a truck. And you're acting as if that is some impossibility? I think it's the easiest thing in the world. Sorry, it just is incredibly, incredibly frustrating to have to watch and listen to this subversion of of logic more than anything else that we see from the mainstream news. Continuing now.
Still lots of disagreement, but no suggestion that they're not going to be finally able to get a resolution through the Security Council. No date on when it might happen, of course, but once the Permanent Five talk again tomorrow, after a couple of hours today, they said they'd meet again tomorrow, and then eventually it will go to the 15-member Security Council.
So how long could this process take all up, that the world is waiting and watching and hoping that these weapons can be destroyed soon?
Yes, well, when it comes to the bureaucracy of the UN, speed is not one of the terms that is used often. We saw John Kerry, the Secretary of State, on Capitol Hill here in Washington briefing congressional members just this afternoon, and his message to them was the only reason we've got this far is because the US put the threat of physical violence against Syria, the threat of war and retaliation on the table.
All right, I think that's enough of that. of course, yes, the old refrain there from John Kerry that that threats are really what works. Gunboat diplomacy, the diplomacy of force, again, a logical contradiction. It's the opposite of diplomacy. You can't threaten and make an agreement at the same time. It's not valid. Agreements have to be voluntary, ladies and gentlemen. That is the nature of agreements. If someone has a gun to your head and makes you sign an agreement, then, in fact, that agreement is null and void. I mean, that is actually a well-known legal precept. Agreements have to be voluntary. Let's turn now to another story here from the mainstream. It turns out that some of the core supporters of the US military, traditionally, are actually coming out quite harshly against Obama. We've got Robert Gates, the first defense secretary under Obama, and we've got Leon Panetta, former head of the CIA, both launching into some quite severe criticism of Obama's entire strategy. Speaking at a forum in Dallas, Robert Gates and Leon Panetta disagreed on whether the United States should ultimately carry out a military strike in retaliation for a chemical attack. But both men said Obama should not have asked Congress to approve a strike, and both were skeptical and sometimes sarcastic about Russian-backed negotiations to have Syria turn over its chemical weapons. When the President of the United States draws a red line, the credibility of this country on backing him up is at stake, Panetta said. But Gates said a strike would be like throwing gasoline on an extremely complex fire. He brought up past interventions in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya as examples of how American military action can lead to unintended consequences. He also dismissed attacking Syria to enforce a red line. I believe to blow a bunch of stuff up over a couple of days to underscore or validate a point of principle is not a strategy. Obama had been pushing for a military strike on Syria in retaliation for a chemical attack that the US blames on Assad's forces. I think it's interesting that these insiders are attacking Obama in such a, I guess, in such a pointed way, in such a nasty way, in a way, because it shows that there is incredible disunity in the ranks of the establishment in the US. I mean, of course, these people are not good people, and Panetta obviously just thinks that probably representing the CIA position, they should have just gone in and done it. Then again, some prefer the idea of undermining, overthrow by infiltration. There is not unity within the US administration at all. We'll be right back. Don't go away. With Truth News Radio. And I do hope you stay with us for the second hour of today's show, because I have a very important interview which I'll be doing with Franklin Lamb, who joins us from Damascus in Syria. And he will be with us for the full second hour of the show, and I'll be asking him a lot of questions, folks, about the core questions on the Syria conflict. One of the main things that I want to try and establish is the validity or veracity of the claims that are made that the Assad regime is a brutal, brutal regime, and that that Assad is a brutal, ruthless dictator who is greatly hated and despised by his people. This is what we've heard continually on the mainstream news. Now, of course, I don't expect that Assad is a wonderful, perfect guy. I don't think he's like an ultimately benevolent leader or even a benevolent dictator. I'm sure he's done some bad things. Most of the leaders in that part of the world have. But what I want to get the feel for is how he's perceived by the people there, because that's the most important thing. And I've met many Syrians in Australia who are, they're not Alawites. You know, they're Muslims, but they've said that they support Assad. Now, the claim is often made in the Western media that Assad's only supporters are the Alawites, and that the Muslims almost universally do not support Assad. Well, that's really not true. A Syrian girl, Mimi Alaham, who's been on this show, is not a Christian by background. And many of the people who led the protests that I went to in Sydney in Australia are not Christians either. Again, this is another furphy that's been slipped to you in the mainstream media. But it was also about creating this perception that Assad is this brutal dictator who everyone hates, who is violent and massacres people and just doesn't give them any freedom at all. I do think it's possible that Assad has overstepped the mark in many cases. I think possibly certain groups may have been targeted. Traditionally, these countries have quite severe secret police, and they engage in quite severe methods. But looking from another side of the coin, Syria is a pluralist country, a secular state that respects all religions. And this is so important, folks. In a world which allegedly is awash in Islamic terrorism, you'd think that countries which support the basic principle of a secular state would be embraced with open arms by the West. At least, thank God, you're not trying to establish a caliphate. But no, it's the opposite. It's the exact opposite. Because the powers that be want the caliphate. They want the extremists to get in charge. They were happy that Hamas got in charge of the Palestinians. They engineered that. Of course, they can now say, oh, Hamas is terrible. It's the great game. It's the strategy of tension. Anyone can see it. A child can see it. Anyway, in what is left of the first hour of today's show, I want to cover a little bit of Australian news. I have a story here which illustrates some very, very disturbing trends in the clampdown on people's privacy in Australia. And this article, actually, this video I'm going to play to you, popped up on Infowars.com, and I was surprised I hadn't seen it. So I thought maybe a lot of you haven't seen it either. So I'm going to play to you this clip from Today Tonight. I know it's a trashy television show, but every now and then these trashy television shows tell you something important. So this is about the Australian Bureau of Statistics data collection methods. Here we go.
Now, the Australian Bureau of Statistics serves a very useful purpose, but the way it collects information has upset some Brisbane residents. They're shocked at the questions being asked, but what happens when they refuse to answer is unbelievable. Lisa Goddard has more.
It is a huge intrusion. I feel violated.
In a democratic society, it's completely outrageous.
One knock on your door.
How can I help you?
And your private life is government property.
They can ask me anything they want. There's no limit.
But Chris Leroy says this time the Australian Bureau of Statistics has picked the wrong guy. Chris says he'll go to jail rather than answer intrusive questions about his sex life and when or if his partner will be home alone.
And I'm sorry, I'm not going to sit here and be bullied into giving information when it just doesn't seem right.
Chris was minding his own business at home on a Saturday when an ABS field officer landed on his doorstep, telling him he'd been randomly selected for an 8-month-long survey.
He said, well, basically, if I don't answer those questions now, that I'd be summarily charged by the Australian statistician, I'd be brought before the federal court, and if found guilty, I'll actually be going to jail.
Worried he was being conned, he hit the internet, only to learn he's far from alone.
So, Chris, there's been a lot of comment on this online.
Yeah, absolutely.
Give me some examples.
Well, we had one gentleman who actually said he'd been through the same experience, and he had actually written, we had the field officer repeatedly ask us for details of my wife's sex life and past relationships. We too were threatened with both criminal charges and court action.
People should not be compelled or coerced, let alone threatened or fined for not complying with what's supposed to be a random survey.
Former Senator Natasha Stott-Despoja knows it happens. It happened to her mum.
My mum's case was incredibly rare that she was successful and that they left her alone.
Shirley Stott-Despoja took the ABS on in court after she refused to answer questions about smoking as part of a 7-month survey. She won, but only on a technicality.
I don't rate the average person's chance of beating the ABS, and I think any institution in this day and age that relies on coercion or threats is not only outdated, it's outrageous. To persecute people on those issues seems extraordinarily undemocratic.
And extraordinarily costly. Every day that goes by that you don't answer their questions, you could be fined $170. Last financial year, the ABS took action against nearly 1,500 Australians. 94 cases were referred to the Director of Public Prosecutions.
The frightening part about all of this is none of us are safe. The ABS selects 350,000 homes and businesses each year. And if you're targeted, the only subject you can legally refuse to answer questions on is religion.
I'll just leave it there. I will put that YouTube video on our show notes. Don't you find it incredible that these really surprising, really chilling erosions of democracy are just appearing randomly everywhere you look? And, you know, it's quite often you miss them. I had missed this one. I hadn't seen it. I've always known that that there are penalties for not answering census forms, but that's just one form that comes out every 5 years. I didn't know that the ABS runs other surveys that are much more detailed and go in deeper and sort of data mine much, much deeper and ask some very, very sensitive questions. And that, again, a refusal to engage in these surveys is actually, well, it's a penalty. It's actually, I'm not sure whether it's criminal or not. And I think this is a very, very important point that we need to understand, because people bandy about the word criminal, you know, and the man in the interview as well, he said, well, he was told that, he, you know, it was an offence. Well, actually, you know, that may not be right. And again, what the man was told may not be right. Quite often these people who do this for a job say things that are not actually legally correct. They call this colour of law. We see this in many cases. We see it with vaccines. You know, We see it with the police quite often. When the police want to break up a gathering, they'll say, oh, well, this isn't, you don't have approval to have this street gathering. Well, guess what? You don't actually need approval. It's a free country. And so, again, we've seen it in relation to coal seam gas. And I think I've discussed this on the show, where the government is taking a position and people are coming to the gates of landholders and saying, well, you actually have to allow these people on your land by law. And in fact, you don't. It's just that's their interpretation of the law, and many people are taking that to the courts. So I think it's very important not to simply be bamboozled, even by stories, as we've just seen there, on a commercial television channel, that would give you the impression that that we really live in this Orwellian state and it's already a fait accompli and there's nothing you can do, you know, and you'll go to jail if you don't obey the man who knocks on your door. That is not true either. See, there are so many levels of untruths in this world. It is actually quite difficult to navigate through, you know, the tyranny that we deal with, the deception that we deal with, and to actually find out what the correct path is, we must not be persuaded by those who wish us to be afraid. Now, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, I've just received a notification that Franklin Lamb will not be available for the interview today. I'm very disappointed. He has had to relocate, and we don't currently have a contact for him. I was really looking forward to this interview in the second hour. We are going to be pursuing it in future weeks, and we will certainly be continuing to examine the Syria situation from every possible angle. As I don't actually have any more material lined up for today's show, I'm going to leave it today for this week with the first hour. We'll be playing a replay of one of our recent interviews in the second hour. Do stay for that. I've done some really interesting interviews recently, and whatever we give you in the second hour will certainly be worth listening to if you haven't already caught it. So that's Truth News Radio for this week. It's been great talking to you. I hope you enjoyed the experience. I'll be back next week. See you then.